Hey there, welcome to the Cultivated Family Podcast. I'm Megan Hillica, and this is where we dive into grief and loss, and all that I've learned through the loss of my daughter, Aria. I want to share tools and the things I've learned along the way to help me carry my grief, along with interviews and stories of other people who have experienced pain and heartache in their life, and how we can, as friends, support one another through our tough times so that we can have the joys again as well. You are not alone, my friend, so let's dive in. Welcome to episode number 3. Today I'm visiting with Danelle Beckstrand, where she shares her story of infertility and the hidden grief that comes with that. Danelle is so open about the struggles that come with that and eventually turning to adoption. Danelle and her husband recently experienced the heartbreaking loss of a failed adoption and are on a journey again of finding a baby that they can love and call their child. Please listen in as Danelle shares so much hope, wisdom, and light while talking about such a heavy topic. Hi, Danelle. Welcome to the Cultivated Family Podcast. I am so excited you're here.
Oh, so excited to be here as well.
All right. So before we begin, can you just tell me your story, who you are, and where you come from?
Yeah, absolutely. I live here in Utah. I was born and raised in Utah, and I met my husband in college. We met in a college math class. He passed, I didn't, but that's fine. we got married in December, and this December, we're coming up on our 8th year anniversary. We knew we wanted to have kids all through our whole relationship, and the plan was to graduate college together and then have a million babies, but we found out that we were dealing with unexplained infertility a couple years into trying for a family, and we just have tried the fertility treatment route. We looked into foster care, and we are currently hoping to adopt. And we just like to share our journey and the lessons that we've kind of learned along the way. And it's been several years into our journey, and we just are still on a prayer. We're winging it on a prayer, mm-hmm. and we're still just hoping for the best. So that's our story in a nutshell.
Okay. Can you share with me what unexplained infertility is? So I'm not super familiar with all these terms. Can you share what unexplained infertility is and then what treatments you tried and what they are?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really intimidating for somebody who hasn't been in the world of infertility. There are a lot of terms and a lot of acronyms, and we had to learn all of that when we kind of joined that club, if mm-hmm. you will. And now, as we're kind of entering into the adoption world, we're learning that there's all of all new vocabulary and terminology and new acronyms and everything that we're relearning. But so infertility is typically diagnosed when a couple has tried for at least a year and has had no success getting pregnant. And we had been diagnosed with, you know, they said, okay, it looks like we're dealing with infertility here. We started off with just like an ovulation stimulant. We took Clomid, which is just an oral medication to help stimulate ovulation. And we did 6 rounds of that with just our typical OBGYN. And then when we moved away for a master's program, you know, we decided to kind of dive back into things and went back to an OBGYN office. And she said, you know, I think we need to send you to a fertility specialist, like a fertility clinic. And at that point, I was kind of shocked because I thought, are we really here? Are we at that point? I didn't think it was that bad, right? Like mm-hmm. I was anyway, just still kind of expecting to get pregnant anytime soon. And so we went to the fertility clinic, and they ran tests. So they run blood tests, and you know, they test my husband, they test me, they're looking for hormone levels, they're looking for tube blocks, they're looking for anything they can think of why maybe we're not able to conceive naturally. And every test, every time, just came back great. Okay. Great, but not, right?
Yeah.
So everything looks fantastic, but we're still not getting the results. Mm. And the doctor sat us down and he pulled up our file and he showed us the ultrasounds that he had done. And he, you know, he told us about the tests that they had ran. And he said, everything looks great. This is what we would consider unexplained infertility. And I kind of looked at him and wanted to laugh because I was like, you can't seriously be diagnosing me with that. Like, yeah. that's a made up diagnosis. Like,
there has to be a reason, right?
Right. And so anyway, so he said that it was a common diagnosis and that sometimes we just don't know why our bodies won't let us get pregnant. And so, anyways, so that's kind of how we came to that diagnosis, and that's kind of a little bit of insight into unexplained.
So I think that grief that comes with infertility is a lot of times hidden, or you can't see it as much, or people might not realize it's there. So can you share with me the grief that comes with infertility?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like you're right. I feel like infertility, it doesn't really have a face, right? Mm-hmm. You can't really pick people out in a crowd and just know right away. And sometimes I wish that maybe there was some sort of a sign or something I could wear.
Yeah.
Because I think that's when insensitive comments are made, just purely out of ignorance, right? People just mm-hmm. don't know what's happening and what people are going through. And I think that that doesn't just relate to infertility, but to so many other things. So it's been about 6 years on our journey. And I think that first year, if I'm being totally transparent, every month that, you know, we would find out we didn't get pregnant,
yeah.
I would maybe wipe the sweat off my brow and kind of go, "Woo, good, yeah. close one," right? When you're first trying, that's scary.
Yeah.
That's scary to think, like, are we really ready for this? After that first year, it kind of started getting frustrating. Like, okay, wait, no, we really are ready. You know, what's happening? And then obviously with the diagnosis of unexplained and then going to the doctors. And I would definitely say, I mean, some people will approach me, they'll say, like, I know we haven't tried as long as you have. It's only been 2 years, but this is rocking my world. And I just want to like hug them and say, mm-hmm. no, like that second, that third, those like fourth years, those were so hard,
yeah.
so hard. And now I feel like we're in a really good spot. We've got, you know, hope on the horizon. We kind of have a direction and it's kind of all we know at this point. So mm-hmm. There are other times like hope that we'll adopt, but also maybe we don't have so much hope that we're going to conceive necessarily. So it's yeah. not a huge letdown. But definitely those are some of the hardest years. I think that what people don't realize is it is a very intimate, it's a very vulnerable part of the female reproductive system. That's mm-hmm. vulnerable and very intimate, yeah. but even it brings in, you know, intimacy with the spouse, and it brings in just so many things that are hard to open up about and hard to talk about. And it leaves you feeling very alone, because it's hard to, I don't know, just walk into a room and announce, "Hey, everybody, yeah. I didn't get pregnant this month," right?
Yeah.
like it's just not. And I think there's just a stigma with talking about infertility sometimes. And I am so excited when I see that that's breaking and that that's getting easier for people to open up and talk about. You kind of asked just what that grief looks like. And I think what it looks like is, you know, somebody who's trying to smile through hard days. And it's somebody who's trying to act put together, and somebody who cries in the bathroom at church, and someone who, you know, just is heartsick when she passes the baby aisle at the store, and somebody who, I mean, just craves and wants that little one in her arms and just aches and aches for that. And it's an ugly, ugly place.
Grief is hard and ugly in you know, every form. It is really hard. And it's hard when you feel so lonely in it too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what are some things that people say? You kind of mentioned a little bit about what people say. What are the things that people come up or say or do that is hard when you are living with infertility?
Definitely. I think it's important to acknowledge those. But I've had so many people just because I think it's important to educate. I think it's important to educate people so that people don't, you know, make those same mistakes. But I've had more requests from people saying like, what can you say? Yeah. Right? Because the list could be so long.
No, that's so true.
And what's hard is what's hurtful to me might not be hurtful to someone else. And it might be hurtful one day, but not be hurtful the other day. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's jokes made about like, oh, you know, you can't have kids. You can take mine. And it's like, it kind of, I don't know, diminishes the validity of the hurt that you're feeling. Cause it's like, oh, that's not that funny. Or, I mean, yeah, there's lots of lists of kind of what not to say, but I definitely think if somebody's willing to open up to you about their infertility journey, I love Brené Brown talks about sympathy versus empathy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love her stuff.
Isn't she amazing? Yeah. I adore, if I could sit down and have lunch with one person, it would be her. She's amazing. But she talks about that, and she talks about, you know, when somebody opens up to just say, it's okay to not know what to say. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Yeah. But to just say, I'm just so glad you told me, you know, or just say, hey, like I'm here with you. And I think that when somebody opens up about, their trials with anything really, to not necessarily try to have answers, I think we are so done with people suggesting diets we should try. Positions we should try. Like the advice needs to stop. Yes. The advice. Oh, that is the hardest. But I think just to, you know, to share love. And I do think it's okay to say, not necessarily like, I totally get where you're coming from, because sometimes people will say that. And the truth is their story is so different. Mm-hmm. But instead I think it's appropriate to say things like, I get the heartache in wanting something, but not having it. Right. Cause I think a lot of people can identify with that. Or, you know, I get the faith shaking experiences. Like, mm-hmm. I get that. I can identify with that. And I think it's okay to make those types of connections. I don't think it's helpful to say, oh, I totally get it. Mm-hmm. When you don't, you never could, right?
Yeah. Well, we each have our own story. And so we can't,
totally.
We can't understand 100%, but there's different pieces that you can understand together.
Absolutely. So you can take absolutely.
But I totally get the fixing, you know, people are always trying to fix and help and figure out how to make it better for you. Because I think the thing is, people don't want us to be in pain. When we look at somebody else, we want to try help them and make them better or try to fix the problem. Yeah. But really, we just need to sit with them and listen and honor their story.
Yeah.
Trying to fix it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you guys began the adoption process, and how did that look like, and how did you come to the decision to start that?
Yeah, that is a great question. So we have been very open and transparent about our whole journey. And sometimes I think I'm confusing my followers because I'll be like, oh, no, now we're doing foster care. Oh, no, now we're doing fertility treatments. Oh, wait, actually we're doing adoption. Like, we're confusing ourselves. That's the truth. But we had explored foster care. We took all the classes. The only thing that was left was to do our home study. And there was a weird, just mental wall that we hit that almost felt physical. Honestly, it was just this wall that was like, I don't know. We lost all motivation to finish out our home study. And we just felt stopped. Our hearts felt stopped. And so we kind of just took that as a sign that we didn't need to be moving forward with that at that time. But it is something that has, you know, it still holds a very special place in our heart. And it's still something that we would absolutely look into in the future. And so we, at that point, we had done all this paperwork. We had done physicals. We had done classes. There was a lot of work that went into that application process. And at that time, when we had kind of hit that wall, we heard from our fertility clinic and there was a study that was happening for IVF and it was going to be this great thing. And so we thought, well, maybe this is why, maybe this was our break. And so we were moving forward with the study and things kind of crumbled before it could even start. And we were just heartbroken that it wasn't going to work out the way that we had thought it was. As we kind of took it home, you know, we've always just been very prayerful through our entire journey. And we were just being really prayerful about where do we go now? You know, we keep thinking we're going to hit this break and then it crashes. And so we were just trying to be so prayerful. One morning, gosh, I wish I would have recorded every detail, because I think about this all the time, but I just remember waking up and we were still kind of sleepy. We were in bed and I said to my husband, "What about adoption?" And he said, "Yeah, like, duh, like, why haven't we thought of that?" Like, mm-hmm. It was the weirdest, like, telepathic, like, connection of, like, we were so in sync. We were so on the same page. I can't think of another time in our marriage that's ever happened where it was like neither one of us had to convince the other. It just was. Like, it just made sense. And we were instantly excited. And we connected with a couple people we knew had recently adopted, just kind of asked them their process and what they had done. And we were finished with our paperwork for adoption in like 3 weeks, which is unheard of, I feel like, because I feel like people take months and months, but most of it had been done through foster care and a lot of it carried over. And so that was a huge blessing. Anyway, by the time we had our home study, I mean, so I think my first call to a caseworker was the end of September, and we announced to everyone that we were hoping to adopt in December. So just a few months later, we were able to just have everything wrapped up and ready to go. So yeah.
Seems really fast from what I've heard about adopting. That's really fast to do the paperwork that fast.
It was quick. It felt quick. And there's a lot to it. There's lots of papers. They ask preferences of, you know, what type of child you would be okay with, you know, if it had disabilities or if it had, you know, physical limitations or mental disorders. And it's intense to fill it out. Relationships with family members and childhood personalities. And I mean, there's a lot on there.
Yeah, I have never done that, so I can't imagine the amount of work that you do to do that.
Yeah.
You experienced a great loss just not too long ago when you're planning on adopting a baby. So very, very recent.
Yeah, very recent.
Yeah, can you share that story with us?
Yeah. So, like I mentioned, we had announced that we were hoping to adopt in December. Mm-hmm. And by February, which at the time felt like a lifetime, but looking back, it was only like 8 weeks, 8 or 9 weeks, which is amazing. So by February, we actually had matched with a birth mom or an expectant mom. Okay. And I just recently was corrected on calling someone a birth mom because they're technically not a birth mom until they place. Up until then, they're an expectant mom. Anyway, trying to get all the words right.
Yeah.
So we had matched with her in February. She had found us through Instagram. And we became just instant friends. We talked every day, every single day up until the baby was born. She was just a state away, and she wanted me to be there at the birth, and things were just so perfect, so perfect. And again, we just, looking back, it's like, oh, we thought that was maybe why. That was why everything had come together, right? That's why it had taken this long, because it was this baby who was supposed to be in our home. Mm-hmm. And we ended up being able to fly down there together, my husband and I, to Arizona. And we were actually at the hospital when she delivered the baby. Birth plans had kind of changed, and, you know, we were kind of on our toes and we didn't know what to expect. As time kind of went on, we were able to go into the room and we were able to see that baby, and we were able to hold him, and she had us name him, and we filled out the birth certificate, and we were mom and dad. We were mom and dad. We had the rights for medical decisions anyways. And so we could sign papers and, you know, like witness forms and that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so, everything was so perfect. It just was. He was so sweet. He was almost 10 pounds, just the chunkiest baby. And we loved him so hard. And, the most emotionally draining week of my life. We were on our toes. Obviously, we loved this baby, but nothing was finalized. And no matter how many times people told us that it was going to work out, we still had a little guard up, right? Mm-hmm. And we tried not to because, you know, my husband and I, we just believe in going all in. But I think still just trying to be safe and trying to know, you know, where we didn't want to overstep boundaries and we didn't want to create, you know, hurt feelings, and we wanted to give space, but we wanted to be there with the baby. And it was like we were trying to read everyone's minds and trying to be on our best behavior under this intense working interview as, you know, staff and the birth family, as they watched us fumble as we, you know, tried to change this baby's diaper for the first time. And it was hard. It was hard to just, I mean, you know, we were told by the lawyer and we were told by the nurses and by the social worker at the hospital, you know, this is going to be hard for you, but this is so much harder for her. So you don't get to fall apart here. You don't get to show that it's hard for you, because this is about her. You know, when you go home and when you have that baby, then it can be about you. But here at the hospital, this is about her. I mean, that was the warning before we even went in, honestly. Okay. I have to like preface that it wasn't like we were falling apart. But so we felt very much like we had to be brave. And there were lots of times. So she actually was in the hospital for several days. And there were lots of times that we had to fall apart in the car and then use eye drops to make our eyes wider and concealer to fix my makeup and then walk in like nothing had happened. Right. I mean, it was exhausting, and our sweet families were so excited and they wanted updates and they wanted pictures, and we didn't know. There were signs. Sometimes there were signs that mom was going to change her mind, and sometimes there were signs that she absolutely wasn't. And so it was very somber. It was very hard. It was hard to be excited like a typical birth of, you know, like, I don't know how else to say that. Anyways, so in Arizona, the law is that a mom has to wait 72 hours before she can sign away her rights. And it was getting to the day that she was planning to sign. And I just am realizing as I'm recapping in my mind that I said it had been several days, and honestly, 72 hours, I mean, is that 3 days? Like, that's not that long.
It feels like a lifetime to you.
It did. Yeah. It felt like we were there for a month. And I'm certain we aged, you know, 10 years being there. But it was the day that she could sign papers. And we had a hotel room. We also had a nesting room at the hospital that we were staying in with just me, my husband, and the baby. And just down the hall from the mom. And anyway, I went to the hotel to go check out. My husband stayed at the hospital. And while I was gone, I got a call from my husband, and he said, "Hey, you know, the lawyer's here. And I think she's going to sign the papers." And I was excited and nervous. And I said, "I'm coming." And he said, and he called again, and he said, "The lawyer wants to talk to us." And I said, "Okay, I'm almost there." I walked into that hospital room, and my husband just had red, swollen eyes. He had been crying, and I honestly couldn't tell if he was overjoyed, like if he was crying because he was excited, like she had just signed the papers, or if he was upset. And I felt like he was upset, but that didn't make any sense because I had just talked to the mom like an hour before, and I just was so confused. And I just, you know, I said, what? And he just kept repeating my name. He just said, Danelle. And we sat down on the bed, and the lawyer sat across from us, and she had already told him. And so it was her turn to tell me. And the way she phrased it, she just said, "At this time, this mom had decided to try and parent the child." And that phrasing confused me because I didn't know what she was exactly telling us. And I felt like I was supposed to be falling apart, but I couldn't even comprehend what was happening. And I think that, looking back, was just pure shock.
Yeah.
And I just said, "What do you mean? Is she going to change her mind again? like, are we just supposed to stay here? Like, well, I don't understand what you're saying. And she said, no, at this time, we advise that you go back to Utah. And she told us, you know, we try to tell couples not to burn any bridges in case things change. And that felt like false hope looking back. And that was part of the anger side that came later, feeling, you know, misled, and that conversation shouldn't have happened that way. But I, at the same time, maybe there are moms who do change their minds, you know, but it was, I mean, it was just that idea when we were getting on that plane coming back to Utah of, well, you know, are we leaving too soon? Do we need to stay here? What if things still change? What if things can still change? And so,
there's that still that little bit of hope.
Maybe, absolutely.
You know, instead absolutely. Of it just being like, no, this is done. You're still kind of hoping for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, we lost it. We lost it in that hospital room. And even looking back, I mean, I wrote a blog post on it, and I get a lot of comments about the way that I had kind of described feeling like I wanted to throw up, honestly, feeling like I had been punched in the gut, and I wanted to throw up. And I felt like I was kind of like dry heaving almost. And the nurses like just seemed so concerned about getting me to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I'm like, I'm going to throw up on your floor. Like, and I'm like, I know where the bathroom is. And I remember being like mad that they were showing me where the bathroom was. Like obviously I knew where the bathroom was in that hospital room. And I get a lot of comments on that in the blog post that people are like, that's funny that you mentioned that because it's kind of irrational, right? It's kind of an mm-hmm. irrational thing to be mad about, but it's like when you don't really know where else to grasp, you grasp on anything that you can, you know? Mm-hmm. And I am, if you knew me, you would know that I'm a germaphobe, a little bit. And I've worked in hospitals and I know that they clean them, but I would never willingly, before that moment, I would never willingly sit down on a hospital floor. Like, you would never find me doing that. But I mean, I was walking to the bathroom and I just hugged the wall and I just slid right down to the floor and I just fell apart. I mean, we have been wanting this and praying for this and trying for this for so, so, so long. And it just was too perfect. And we just had so much love for him. We had so much love for this mom. We felt betrayed. We felt like our story was ready to just be over and it just wasn't. And it was just so many emotions. And they actually, the nurses were like, is there someone we can call? And, you know, it was just divine intervention that we actually had friends living in the same city we were in who had just moved down there like 2 months prior. And so I unlocked my phone and I said, call Jake. And they took it out of the room. And at that point he showed up. I mean, I don't even know, like he left work. I don't know. And like, and his wife had the kids at home and they just took us straight to his house and we just fell apart there. And I mean, he carried our empty car seat out to the car. He carried the diaper bag. I mean, he said, you know, you keep this baby stuff here. We went and checked into a hotel. My dad, it was actually the first person I called. I just didn't have the heart to call my mom. I'm very close with my mom. I couldn't say it. And I called my dad and we cried. We cried so hard on the phone that was when we were still at the hospital while we were waiting for our ride to come get us. And he either called me or texted me and he just said, I got you a hotel. All you have to do is show your ID. You don't even need to say your name. And we knew we couldn't get a flight home until Friday. And at that point, I think it was a Wednesday. I'm getting caught up in all the details. As I'm reliving this, but just having that support of people who just engulfed us. I'm like, I don't even know, the blur. It really is. I don't even know how we got from our friend's house to the hotel. And I couldn't really tell you much past that. I just know it wasn't pretty. And I remember thinking, I have cried so hard, I don't think I have any tears left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then somehow finding more tears. And then the sensation that follows me or haunts me is honestly just like eyes so swollen, you can't even sleep. They were so swollen from just crying so hard. And just, I was trying everything to relieve that because that it was so uncomfortable for some reason. I don't know like why that felt so uncomfortable, but oh, just a mess of ugliness. And, you know, having, while that's happening, having sweet friends who with the best of intentions are texting us congratulations. They just found out we had the baby. So it was,
and they don't know yet.
They don't know. Yeah. Exactly. And yeah. We're like, how, you know, how soon is it to tell everybody? Right. Yeah. You know, we need this time to grieve, but we need to tell people because people are still congratulating us. Like anyway, so
yeah. Thanks for sharing that. It is so hard and so painful. And I'm so sorry that you have experienced that.
Definitely rocked our world. But, you know, we have found a lot of good and beauty that has still come from that experience and past heartbreaks. And we feel incredibly humbled when we think about who helped take care of us, strangers, people we knew. We came home with our fridge full of food. Neighbors had broken into our house to fill it. And not literally, they have the garage code, but
yeah.
I mean, people rallied around us and they still rally around us. And it was so wonderful to have a space on my blog and over kind of on my corner of the internet, just to share so openly what we were dealing with. It was very healing and very therapeutic to be able to open up about that. And you know what? It's another scar. It's another scar in our hearts, and parts of us won't ever be the same, but that's okay. Cause I feel like that's the purpose of this, you know, to grow and to progress and to be better. So
It definitely leaves scars, but that's what I found is the scars, they change you, but you can also embrace that as part of you now. You know, it can be
absolutely
part of your story and it can be beautiful too, but it can take time to get there.
Absolutely. It sounds like an oxymoron and it sounds really weird, but I love these parts of our story. It really has shaped us. That was all I was going to say is exactly what you're saying. And I know it's weird. It's weird to love the heartache. That sounds twisted, but it's what's brought us close to God. It's what's brought us close together. It truly has been good.
I totally get it. I feel like it almost deepens your perspective on life.
Absolutely.
It's really difficult to go through. It's so hard, but it also can have some good parts.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it sometimes takes time to get there.
Yeah.
So in your blog, you talked about the ways that you realized that you're coping that weren't serving you.
So yes.
What was that like, and what do you mean by that?
Absolutely. So I think the hard part about grief is that it's just a beast that is so hard to navigate. You never really know how you're going to feel. You never really know when something's going to trigger you. That's at least been my experience. It's just been tricky to navigate. And so often when we were in the beginning stages of the healing, we had friends who would offer to, you know, take us out on the town. Like let's go do something. Let's go do something fun. And I sometimes really needed that. And sometimes couldn't get there. Mm-hmm. And I never knew what day that was going to be. And so I had a hard time planning things far in advance. It was just day by day. With that, I found other things like, I guess I found that I was on social media a lot and we kind of became these little hermits that didn't really want to leave the house. And we didn't really want to, and people understood, right? And people would validate that. They'd be like, good for you. You need to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I just binge watched, you know, 3 series, not just seasons. No, just kidding. I would get to a point where I'm like, it's not healthy though. Like when I had poor eating habits and I was learning to get how to get out of it. But I find myself when in crisis or when dealing with grief, it's just easy to jump into some of those mindless, mind-numbing habits. And again, mine is just endless scrolling and endless watching and not really connecting and not really, you know, going outside and getting fresh air or sunshine. And I just was finding I was so distracted at work. I was constantly, you know, and I think one of the battles I face is Instagram is one of the ways that we're hoping to build our family. Mm-hmm. That's one of the ways that we're advertising that we're doing a private adoption. And that's how our first birth mom found us, or our expectant mom. And so to me, I feel like I always have to be on and always have to be checking messages. And I always have to, you know, cause I'm like, mm-hmm. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is how we move forward. And then I find that it's not serving me. It's not, it brings negativity. It brings, you know, distracted, wily thoughts, like of just overstimulated thoughts, right? Like, anybody who's been distracted gets that, but my brain would just jump from like topic to topic to person to topic to person. Like, it was all over. And I'm like, I just needed to unplug. I needed to quiet my brain and put down my heavy heart. And I wasn't listening to my own thought, like my grieving thoughts. And I wasn't giving myself the love and the care and the nourishing, you know, time that it needed to heal. And I was just kind of trying to put a band-aid over it. So that was kind of what I discovered. And I decided that there were a couple things that I needed to do. And so one, I ended up cutting back hours at work, which was very helpful, because that allowed me to take a slow morning and to write in my journal. Writing has really helped. I try to, this sounds so hippy dippy, but I try to do like a body inventory. When I lay in bed in the morning, I go from head to toe. And I think again, this sounds so weird. And I know I'm with you. If you think it's weird,
it's not, I don't think it's weird. I'll keep describing what you do. Amazing.
I start with my forehead and I try to relax the muscle, and I think about the lines that, you know, form when I make expressions with my forehead, and I make sure everything's relaxed, and I say, like, how are you, forehead? You feeling good? You know? And if I feel good about it, I'm like, okay, you know, my forehead can relax and it's good. So we're good there. And I can go to my eyes and I say, you know, how are you? And I say, thank you for, you know, all the work that you're doing. And then I can go down and I can relax my cheeks and I can go to my throat. And that's when I can notice, like, okay, my throat's really tight and I can tell I'm holding stress there. And I can tell that, you know, I have a lot of weight on my chest, and I can feel my shoulders are heavy. And so then I can just go through and I can validate and say, you know, no wonder your shoulders feel heavy. Like, you're carrying a lot on your shoulders right now. And I can go through and you know, how is my stomach, and how do my legs feel, and how do my hips feel? And I can just go all the way down to my toes and just validate, not question or judge anything that any part's feeling. But that is a habit that I kind of had fallen out of, but it's something that has been so helpful as I kind of wake up and get my day started. And you know, my husband and I try to sleep with our phones outside of our rooms. We try to charge them outside of our rooms. And I've been trying a lot more to get daylight and sunlight and, you know, be outside more, than I was. And so anyways, I'm finding ways to replace, the kind of those brainless, mindless, negative, they're all ways that people relax, and they are relaxing, and I still totally do it. But I think what it was it wasn't fueling my soul like I wanted it to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the difference is, this is the way I see it, the numbing of the emotions and allowing yourself to process versus now you're doing all these amazing things. I love that what you described about what you do in bed, because there's so many emotions and trauma and stuff that is stored in our body, and just paying attention to it and noticing it is so incredibly helpful. I have done that in my therapy sessions so much. And I know, like, for myself, I've had a lot of, you know, the heaviness or stress or pain in my chest too, or my neck. And when you start to notice that, you can help release it, but you can't notice it if you are numbing,
busy, like, not, yeah,
being too busy and not paying attention or not noticing. And that's absolutely amazing. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for accepting that and not being like, you weirdo.
No. I don't think that's weird at all. I think that's awesome. Did you do that before? Like, have you done that as a practice before? Or
I have, but it's something that it was introduced to me through therapy and through kind of a conference that I had gone to, but it's all through trying to find ways to cope with infertility. Okay. So it's not ever something that I had ever considered even before, but obviously we've had a lot of growth in the last 8 years of being married and the last several years of trying to have children. And so in that time, you know, along the way, I've picked up some good tricks, and I've learned, again, like you said, just validating the feelings and the emotions. And again, not saying like, go away, or, oh, I hate that it feels that way. Right. But just to be like, hey, I get it. I know why your shoulders hurt. Right. I know exactly why your chest feels heavy. Like, you feel that if you need to feel that, right? And so that's been definitely a good practice.
Yeah, it is. It's so hard to face our pain or emotions that we have, because I mean, who wants to feel them, you know?
Right.
I think totally. It's so important to allow space for them, and
yeah, absolutely
notice them.
And at that point, they don't control you anymore, right? Yeah. You can control them. Yeah. And I think that's what's really important as well.
Yeah. Danelle, I want to thank you for sharing your story. I think it's so important to honor our stories and share them and let people know they're not alone. There's so Absolutely. Many things we all face and struggle and sometimes feel really alone in them. So I really appreciate taking the time to share.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I have some questions at the end that I call cultivating compassion.
I love that.
So I want to dive into those. So what is one thing you could offer to someone who is struggling and feels really alone in their pain?
Honestly, I have learned, the biggest lesson I've learned through all of this is that you can't rank trials from more hard to less hard. And I think that's what isolates us, is when we feel like we can't connect with people through our trials because we feel like our trial is so much harder than theirs ever was, or we're saying their trial is so much harder than ours is. And it creates this, again, just this feeling of isolation that nobody could ever relate. And I think that sometimes when we're grieving or going through hard things, we need to take a little bit of accountability as well and look for ways to connect with others, because I think connection is key. I think that that is how we heal. And I think if somebody's feeling alone, I would definitely say, you know, to take a step back and see what people really can offer you. I remember just getting mad at people trying to connect with me when they couldn't possibly understand. And I realized that's when I felt most alone, was it in those times. So
that's really good. I like that. I think comparing our griefs or comparing the way, you know, what we've gone through is, I can see that it can separate you from connecting.
Yeah.
So what is one book that has encouraged you and helped you through this?
There's actually two. There's two books.
Go ahead and share the book.
That I love, love, love. Okay. Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown, who I mentioned earlier. She's amazing. And I love all of her books. I don't know why I love that one the most. I think it's because it's the first one I read of hers. Mm-hmm. But I just, the self-love and the permission to have self-love, I devoured it. I loved that book.
It's a really
and
good book.
I also just like have a disclaimer. I'm not a big reader. So the fact that I have these two books, that's a big deal.
Yeah,
okay. The second book is A Million Miles in a Thousand Years by Donald Miller. Okay. And he basically writes about how to live a good story. So there's elements of a story that make it good, right? There's a protagonist and a climax, and right, there's different parts to a story when you're writing it. And he kind of teaches how to apply that to your life and how to live your best story. And that one I've listened on Audible probably 8 or 9 times.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like, I love it. It's ridiculous how many times I've listened to it now, but
that's great. What do you wish someone who has never been through infertility or failed adoption would understand?
Oh, I could probably give you a whole list of things. But I think what it comes down to is I think it's just another reminder of how important it is to treat everybody like they're going through, you know, their worst heartache. Mm-hmm. I think that we just can't make assumptions, and we can't, not to say we can't just have conversations about family or friends or anything, but I just don't think that, I think it's important to just be compassionate to all people. Mm-hmm. And as an example, I was reading a story the other day, and it was this boy who at the time he was 16 and he was honestly on his way to take his life, and he was on a bus and he just kept praying and wishing that somebody would just ask him how his day was going. He felt like that was just going to turn his whole plan around. And actually the story goes into how he had survived, kind of what he put himself through. And he kind of can talk out on that now, but never did anybody stop and just ask him, you know, how's your day? How are you? He said he had tears streaming down his face and nobody stopped him, and, or like nobody even looked at him. Right. And my heart just ached. And I feel like, because I hope I never do that. I hope I'm never the person who doesn't ask someone how their day is. And I think that when anybody's going through any trial, whether it's infertility or, you know, illness or anything, I think it's so important that we don't make assumptions, that we're always compassionate, and that we're always willing to just treat each other with kindness, no matter what, you know,
just sitting with them. That's really,
yeah,
really good.
That and something else that you, when you said just sitting with them, I just pictured my neighbor who just came over with her two little kids and they were playing with our kitty. And it just meant the world when people share their kiddos with us. Mm-hmm. I love the sweet moms who have invited us to dance recitals. We go to the, you know, people who we've gone to the pool with, or there's things that would be weird for us to go to as adults without kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we just were at the park, right? And so can't be those people. And so when people just invite us to be a part of their families, and we get to play games with their kids, and we get to, you know, show their kids our chickens and or whatever it is. Yeah. It means the world to us, really.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me here. I really appreciate it. And thank you for sharing your story. Where can people connect with you?
Yeah. Your journey? So our blog is, our blog and our adoption profile are kept on at www.wecallitajourney.com. And then my Instagram page is over at We Call It A Journey. And we just launched our shop, actually. So it's a reopening, and our shop is the Journey Market, and you can purchase items there and that are meant to uplift, connect, and encourage others. And they are, the proceeds are to help us continue our journey of building our family. And so those are kind of some of the places that we're at, just here and there, everywhere.
Yeah. All right. I will put those in the show notes so that people can get there a little bit easier. Awesome. All right.
Well, thanks so much, Megan.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for joining me on another episode of the Cultivated Family Podcast. While this episode is over, you can continue to join me in conversation on Instagram or Facebook at Cultivated Family. I would love to see you there.